Welcome to Books and Beer. I am your host, Michael Malone, here at the Oath Craft Beer Sanctuary in Tarrytown on a perfectly sunny fall day, ready to discuss, as the show's title suggests, books and beer, as well as music and travel and punk culture around the world, because my guest is Franz Nicolai, the musician and more recently the author. Franz's book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar, was recently published, detailing his music tour of bars and clubs and squats around the former Eastern Bloc. Franz has spent many years playing keyboards for Brooklyn band The Hold Steady and is a prolific solo artist as well. Franz, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
Appreciate you coming. You ever been to Tarrytown before?
I mean... yeah, but not. I haven't spent any significant time. I had a girlfriend from Ardsley for a bunch of years.
So okay,
I've been through, but not in so much.
I got you. Okay. So tell me how the book came to be.
The book came to be. I had, I'd been a touring musician for a bunch of years. One of the things about being a touring musician is you end up having a bunch of free time on your hands that you can fill in various ways. And you know, the first couple of years, you tend to fill that by drinking in
yep.
the bars that you are in, and then sort of the novelty of that wears off, and I started filling it by writing, and just sort of was on a pace of writing longer and longer form stuff, and it seemed like the next step was to try and do a book-length manuscript. What that was about was not necessarily as clear,
mm-hmm.
or what it was going to be about, but... circumstances came to be that I was going to do a six-month tour that was essentially literally around the world tour, including the central chunk was a month on the Trans-Siberian Railroad,
mm-hmm.
playing shows along the way. And so I thought, well, this seems like a good opportunity.
Yeah.
I kept detailed notes with the book, with the idea of making it into a book project. Increasingly detailed notes as I got better at it.
Okay. Writing in a notebook or typing away on your phone? How did you
type it away on the phone? I mean,
wow.
Yeah. We didn't bring a good chunk of this was with my wife Maria, and we didn't bring a laptop for security reasons.
Okay.
So we had our two phones and an iPad.
I gotcha.
And so I did a lot of typing into the notes function of my phone.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, the part of that is, because I was sort of sub rosa interviewing people,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to write down what people were saying. You know, there's a way in which having a notebook would be inhibiting,
right?
If I was constantly pulling it out and scribbling down, but you know, the manners of today are such that people don't even blink if you pull out a phone and sort of start taking, punch some things into it. They think you're just texting
that's
or responding
right,
to
right.
an email. So
interesting. Okay. One thing that struck me, it's a fun book. It's just full of rich details from that corner of the globe. But the fact, I don't know if it's fact, but you certainly seem to roll with the punches exceedingly well. Like this stage of my life, I only want to travel with some degree of comfort. I only want
sure.
to stay in decent hotels, but you put up with all sorts of inconvenient aspects of travel, and you seem like it was all kind of part of the experience for you.
You don't have a choice, do you?
It's
the tour is booked.
The choice is not go, I guess.
The choice is not go, but that was a part of my life where I was a full-time musician. My entire financial life was built up around the idea of doing 200-some shows a year. A lot of those, depending on where you're going, you don't know what you're getting into, but you sort of have to do it to get the next place.
Sure, sure.
You know, it's even if it's a terrible show, you might need that 50 euros to
right.
get to the next good show.
Right, right. Interesting.
Now, I don't do that kind of touring that much anymore.
Okay.
So I've also reached the point in my life where... For a variety of reasons, not least of which is I had a daughter three and a half years ago, where I now prefer to do the 50 good shows a year rather than the 50 good shows a year plus the 150 mediocre to poor shows.
Right. Well, it's a fair point. I mean, you've been a working musician probably half your life or so, mm-hmm. so you've traveled and slept and all sorts of...
That's right.
Not and, so glamorous.
Well, and one of the other things about... especially when I started doing solo touring, is that I made a mental division between the shows that were gonna subsidize the places that I was interested in going.
Okay.
So there was the punch the clock shows, and then there was the adventure shows.
Okay.
And these definitely fell.
One for them, one for you, right?
Something like that.
Like the
yeah.
film industry.
Yeah. Okay. That's right.
Okay. Tell me about how it went from a bunch of notes to a manuscript and how you ended up getting an agent to represent
it. Sure. Well, I came home. The initial tour that this was based around was between something like March and August of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I came home in 2012 and with my notes and started writing. Then I went on another six-week tour a couple months later, so that put a pause in it. I had finished a draft about January of 2013. So, I don't know, September to January, minus 6 weeks, couple months of writing.
Yeah.
And then I went back to Europe for 7 weeks that spring after having finished the manuscript. That added some of the material, the Bulgaria and Romania particularly sections yeah. were from that trip. And then I started sending the manuscript out. Before I even left, I had written up a proposal and pitched it around, but of course, you know, first time author, nobody's interested in
sure.
the proposal.
I know
without
well.
The manuscript. So fine, no harm, no foul.
Right.
And then a friend of mine who's a writer, gave me links to a couple databases of agents. I think, you know, the Publishers and Writers database and another one. And I just went through and, as anyone would do, just picked out the one agents who said they were interested in travel writing, in popular culture, in, you know, Eastern Europe and Slavic regional study politics and studies. And in the end, I sent out about 100 queries. Got three-ish, maybe four, depending on how you count it, agents who were enthusiastically interested.
Yeah.
Met with them and picked one, and it went from there.
Okay.
I ended up adding another chapter based on going back to Ukraine in 2013 in the wake of 2014 in the wake of the Maidan Revolution.
Okay. Now, did your agent or your editor end up drastically reshaping the book, or was it pretty much what you had in mind?
Well, I did a round of revisions for the agent, and then I did a couple rounds of revisions for the editor at the New Press, Sarah Fan, who's now at Lapham's Quarterly.
Okay.
The major change was there was a chapter on China that we took out just to make it a more coherent, you know, the Slavic post-communist
okay.
world, rather than throwing China into the mix.
I gotcha.
Also, China is currently nominally communist, so
right.
there's also that. So I don't know that. I mean, that's there was some talk of trying to pitch that to a magazine, or you know, I don't know where that's going to find a home.
Okay.
But that was the major change.
Okay.
And they wanted more personal stuff in it, and. Which, you know, of course, for me, the interesting stuff was not so much about the shows or about myself necessarily, because that's what I lived with.
Right.
But you know, that was the major rewrite.
Yeah. And tell me that feeling when, I did forget to mention our beers here, and I appreciate you hoisting yours
sorry, I got
slightly premature. No, it's fine. I usually mention them at the top. So today, and we will get back to the question that I had in mind, if I can keep it in mind, we will sample the Kunin 2011 Dark Heathen Triple Bock, which is a beast of a beer weighing in at 12.5% alcohol. That is out of Michigan, and then we will be sampling, much closer to home, the 6.5 Beans Imperial Porter out of Brooklyn. That too is a beast at 10%. So somebody here is clearly trying to put us under the table, but we're...
You can track my my increasing slurring as the hour goes
okay.
on.
Okay, but first I wanted to ask you, the feeling when you heard from your agent that you did indeed have a deal. What was that like? Where were you?
I was in Canada.
Okay.
I had driven up to I had a couple shows in Montreal and Toronto. And, excuse me, my wife and I had had lived in Canada for a year, a few years earlier than that. That's where I finished the manuscript, was in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I was out for some drinks with some friends who were colleagues of my wife's at the University of Toronto.
Well, that's a great setting. You already got a few in you, and you end up with this, if not life-changing, certainly...
Yeah, not unlike this, a mostly empty bar, too late in the day.
right.
And he said, yeah, the New Press is interested. And I said, what's the New Press? And he explained, and he told me their offer. And, I was just, every step of the way, it seemed more and more likely that it was going to get, that it was going to become a real thing. And so there it was. In the moment, it was dampened a little bit because I had this figure in mind, financially.
Okay.
Where I was hoping I would be able to pay off my student loan.
I don't know where you got that idea.
Because there wasn't that much left.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite get there. So that was a little bit disappointing.
Welcome to the publishing business.
But there it is anyway, yeah.
Okay. That seems like a great moment to officially hoist our brews here.
Yes.
So we're going to start with a Kunin. Like I said, it's the Dark Heathen Triple Bock, and I got a little info on it here. Actually, it's a cool story. It was a man who owned a hardware store in Warren, Michigan, and his sons took over the business, ended up selling home brewing supplies out of the hardware store, and sold so many home brewing supplies. And this was as the big box stores were kind of taking over the hardware biz, so they made their business entirely homebrew supplies, and then converted it to a brewery, which opened in 2001. So neat story behind the Kunin Dark Heathen. I know you had a head start here, but let's give it a sip.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Utmo.
What do you think?
It's delicious.
You don't have to like it here. Just be honest.
I mean, I do.
Okay.
I'm not a beer expert by any means. I'll leave the describing of it to you.
Oh no! What comes to mind? A little bit of rum, a little bit of almost like a winey taste. I mean, it's so big.
There is something winey about it.
Yeah.
A little bit, obviously thicker than a wine, but
yeah. It's
there's a wininess to the glass.
Yeah. We let the guys here pick our samples and they've served them up in these beautiful little glasses here.
Slightly syrupy,
syrupy. Yep, a little tiny bit of chocolate maybe, and it's a, what would you say, a dark brown. We've got it
certainly.
Up next to the 6 point, and that is black as night. So this is a little bit lighter.
Not too much of a bite in it.
No, it's smooth. It's malty. A lot of sweetness. You know,
very sweet.
You may not picture a beer quite this big having the sweetness, but definitely taste it there. Okay, one you would probably have after a gig as opposed to before a gig. You think?
After, I don't think I would touch anything like this anywhere around a gig.
Okay.
If only because around a gig you want your alcohol intake to be predictable.
I gotcha.
And this is a common rookie mistake for touring acts.
Yeah.
Is to want to sample the local craft brews wherever you are.
Okay.
And so you can get really keel-hauled if you get one that has a little more oomph than your betting on. So really the best bet, this is my advice to a young touring musician.
Okay, all right.
Is to,
from the wise old sage Franz here, what do you got?
Let me get up on my Yeah. Drink beer as you know if you have a show.
Okay. Like, okay.
You know, you always know what one bud, two buds, six buds, eight buds will do to you.
I gotcha.
Whereas the local no-name craft brewery, you know, you could have two of them and be in no shape come right. showtime.
At least read the fine print that has the alcohol by volume on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But that's tough if you're touring foreign countries. You don't know the beers. You may not speak the language.
A lot of times what they're, you know, there's choice doesn't always play into it either, though. You have the beers that they're offering you for free.
I gotcha.
And those are often not the, like...
Not the top shelf, right?
Not the top shelf.
Probably the weaker ones, too, which may be for the best.
I mean, they want to give you local shots a lot, but you also... pretty much know where a shot leaves you.
Sure, sure.
That's a lot more standardized.
Right.
Usually, especially in Europe, you're usually dealing with some kind of Pilsner or lager.
Right, okay. A little bit easier. So
also, at the end of a show, you're often thirsty. So right. You want something a little watery that you can drink quickly.
Okay, makes sense. How do you describe your music? It's sort of a number of genres melded together. Who are your influences?
How do I describe my music? I mean, I play in a bunch of different worlds.
Yeah.
Right? So I was a jazz-trained pianist. I was a classically trained composer. I play the accordion in a Balkan jazz band and in punk bands. I made most of my living as a piano player in rock bands.
Mm-hmm.
Founded and I'm a board member on a long-running chamber music organization, and the records that have come out under my own name for the most part are, you know, wordy songwriter records for lack of a better
all over the map then.
You know, when I was a younger, ambitious musician just moved to New York, it was just a matter of, like, I'm going to acquire a toolkit and just say yes to everything.
Yeah.
Like, throw everything against the wall, see what sticks, hope something that sticks enough that it'll subsidize the other things.
Okay.
But... not want to be defined by any one of the things.
I gotcha. Okay.
And that's still sort of where I stand on that.
One thing that I kept wondering about while reading the book, you were able to get crowds, some kind of crowds, in these pretty remote corners of the globe.
Mm-hmm.
But what size audiences were you getting? I'm sure it was a wide range from one on up to a much larger number, but what kind of crowds did you get?
From 0 to 100,
okay.
Depending.
Okay.
I mean, it just totally depends.
Yeah.
You know, there's something. You don't have to go far to go to a place that's off the beaten track.
Yeah.
You know, even in the United States, there are a lot of places that are off the touring circle.
Yeah.
I mean. The formula for that is to go to a college town that's within an hour of a city.
Okay.
Because then you have a captive audience who knows music that bands don't come to.
Okay.
Right? So, like, Duluth was always a good spot for the Hold Steady, or Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Huh.
Or, you know, Madison for World Inferno in the early years was always great.
Okay.
You know, that... Yeah, exactly. Or like, there's places in the suburbs of Chicago which can be great.
Yeah.
Just because it's a little too far for them to conveniently go to Chicago.
Okay, so there's a sense of gratefulness that a band thought to come their way.
Gratefulness puts an emotional edge on it that sounds pompous.
Okay.
But it's just like the people who are interested, who want something to do, and you're something to do. In a place where a lot of the things to do are coming close, but not that close.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you know, some of the farther-flung places in Siberia, let's say, that I was going, there is more of that aspect of, like, these are young kids with the internet who are attuned to American and British music, and people don't really go there, and so they'll come out.
Okay. What was the low light of the tour? Or the tours?
of the tours. I mean, I got robbed in Paris in 2013 on a tour. You know, not even in any one of these little shitholes. In Paris, robbed for my bag, you know, the one tour bag that had my laptop and all my tour cash up until that point. Jeez. So, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 euros. And this was at the point, you know, I set up the tours usually, so there's a couple weeks where I know I'm going to make the money, and then a couple weeks where I may not make any money, but it's places I want to go to.
Yeah.
And the places where I knew I was going to make the money where it's already behind me at that point.
Oh, jeez.
So, that was one of those inflection points where my enthusiasm for doing this stuff had never quite recovered after that.
Now, did somebody rob you to your face or
from from backstage while I was playing, just grabbed the bag,
man,
and split.
Jeez.
So, you know, on the one hand, you know, like, okay, fine, I shouldn't have left that bag in the backstage room, but
what,
like,
you think that's a safe spot.
You hope. Yeah. You hope. And it's like there's only so much you can do. Like, this is the touring thing, like all these bands that get their vans broken into, people are then like, well, somebody should sleep in the van. It's like, really? Every night?
Right,
somebody's
got to
sleep in the van? Like, you can't just, like, there becomes so many barriers to honestly trying to make a living as a musician, that if you have to keep all your valuables on your person at every second and sleep in the van and, you know, make sure nobody's trying to cheat you, and all these other things, at a certain point, just like, fuck it.
Right.
It's not worth it.
No, you really have to love the music to stick with it.
Jeez. Even if you love the music. Like, there's a reason, I don't know, I'm going to get up on a rant at this
point.
Go
for it, man. Like, we'll blame the Kunin.
Yeah. But there are so many barriers to anyone wanting to do music seriously in this day and age. Like, all of the documented ones that most people are aware of that are systemic to the industry, that, you know, and musicians are resilient because we do want to keep doing it. It's like, okay, so you can't sell records anymore. Okay, now we got to do touring. Oh, you're going to do touring? People are going to rob you.
Right.
Okay, people are going to rob you. You're not going to do touring. Well, I'll just, you know, try and do whatever, Kickstarter. And then people get resentful if musicians do too well on Kickstarter.
Right, right.
It's like, okay, well, you know, we're going to replace torrenting with streaming. Oh, there's, you know, you get a tenth of a penny for streaming.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't actually... people care about music.
Yeah.
They don't think deeply about... There's a sense in which the assumption is that music is some kind of public trust that magically appears.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think people think deeply about that.
Everything you're saying applies to the book publishing world as well, too.
Here's the thing that I think is different.
Okay.
And in my limited experience in the book publishing world, comparing it to the music publishing world, there's a very fundamental reason I think that piracy has never taken off in the book world in the same way that it did in the music world, which is twofold. One is that people don't read as many books.
Right.
I mean, not as many people read books
as
consume music. The two is, it takes longer to consume a book, and that's a barrier for people. Like, you can download 100 records and reasonably expect to listen to them in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
Because you can listen to a record in 30 to 60 minutes.
Right, right.
If you download 100 books, most people don't read 100 books in their life.
Right.
You know? Like, book people can read 100 books in a year.
Sure.
But nobody does that.
Right, right.
And so that's like a fundamental, I think, firewall for the publishing industry in terms of moving into the digital world.
Okay, okay. Heartening for the publishing industry, I guess. So kind of a big, broad question here, but obviously a very... eventful, tumultuous couple of weeks here in the States. I'm curious what Trump, and I don't really want to talk politics, I think we're all kind of sick of it, but Trump's ascension and Brexit months back, what does it mean for punk here, punk around the world? I get the sense that unpopular leaders is kind of red meat for the punk world. But what do you think these international events mean for the punk scene? Anything?
I'll start with a very practical thing
about
Brexit, which is that it's going to make it very, very difficult for touring musicians, especially because Britain is a huge exporter of music and of touring bands to the rest of Europe. And Britain, in return, is a fruitful place for European bands to come tour because of the relative strength of the pound vis-a-vis the euro up until Brexit. Right. Britain's always been a great place for me to play because of the strength of the pound against the dollar. You go there, you get paid, you bring home, if you're bringing pounds back to the United States, you're getting a 50%, you know, anywhere from a 25 to 100% bonus, depending on where the currency is at.
Substantial.
And if British bands can't go and tour Europe visa-free, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
That's really cutting into a lot of people's livelihoods. As far as the more general aesthetic question, I mean, this is one of those things you heard a lot in the first couple of days after the election. Just like, well, at least we'll get some good music out of it.
Hmm.
And that drives me berserk.
Okay, how come?
Because I don't think, for a couple of reasons. Or the other reaction that sort of drove me nuts was people saying, well, how do I respond to this as an artist? And I guess I have to tackle those two things separately. To tackle the second first is going to sound deeply cynical, but I mean it as a realist.
Go for it.
Which is that if the Trump reaction is about anything, it's a reaction against people who consider themselves cultural and intellectual elites, which, if anything, includes writers and musicians.
Yeah.
And so the idea that the best thing you can do as a response to it is run to your art and raise the flag of art seems to me to be missing the point in the most fundamental way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite emotionally ready for the second half of that, which is we must find our way to empathy with these people.
Right.
So the best, I mean, I feel like if you look through what musicians with leftist politics think of as the golden ages of protest music, you're thinking about the anti-Vietnam era, you're thinking about anti-Reagan and Thatcher, you're thinking about anti-Iraq war and W. Bush. What all of those things have in common is total inconsequentiality in terms of actual policy.
Huh.
You know, music...
All for naught.
It's good for rallying the troops, but we have plenty of rallying the troops going on in social media.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can write the best protest song in the world. You know, the Vietnam War didn't end because of protest songs. It ended because we lost. Reagan and Thatcher were successful in their programs. The Iraq War did not end. You may argue has still not ended.
Right, right.
Bush was reelected in 2004 despite all of the Rock Against Bush efforts, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So there's a despair for me in thinking about like that as the great hope of the era.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's fine, like okay, you can make the people who already agree with you feel better, but that arguably is what got us to where we are today, is just people talking to themselves and making themselves feel better.
Right, right.
The only convincing argument I've heard on that front so far is from a writer friend of mine who said, well, as a writer, we have a responsibility because we're in this inflection point of history to record what it feels like in this moment.
Mm.
Like the shock, the despair, the vindictiveness, the name-calling, the loss of comedy in the comity
comedy
in the country. because that's something that people are interested in
yeah.
down the line. Like, one of my inspirations for this book, for the book, was Rebecca West, whose book Black Lamb, Grey Falcon is about traveling to Yugoslavia in the 1930s, and one of in the interwar years, where she went there to try and understand for herself why the First World War happened.
Mm-hmm.
But during the course of writing it and talking to people in the then Kingdom of Yugoslavia, you can feel the uprisings of fascism in the air,
yeah. right,
in her writing, the way she presents it. And in her epilogue, she says, you know, this, I'm presenting this for what it's worth, essentially. But that she had this thought that if we had a diary of a woman in Rome in 450 AD, you know, like the Cavafy poem about waiting for the barbarians, mm-hmm. you know, this the sense of unease, the sense of something, you know, monumental coming, like that would be a useful document,
sure.
even if it was before all the events happened, and so that I can understand as a defense of the arts in this moment,
almost music as journalism.
Well, writing as journalism, music. Again, music. It's I don't know what the role of music is in this moment.
Mm. Mm.
I would be interested in someone giving me a convincing practical utility of it.
Do you think that your take on this changes over time, that this is just kind of too fresh, and maybe over time you start to think that maybe you do turn a single or change someone's mind by the songs and getting people together in the shows and all that?
I don't know. Does it work the other way? Do people listen to Oki from Muskogee or any like pop country song, and people on the political left,
mm-hmm.
and have their minds changed?
Probably not. I thought of it that way. Yeah, yeah.
do people on the, so I mean, obviously popular culture is dominated by the progressive left, politically yeah. speaking, and I think that's part of the problem. I think that's part of the reaction, right? That the people who are Trump sympathists probably do feel oppressed by popular culture
yep.
in that way. But are they going to go searching out political viewpoints from the left in search of being convinced?
Probably.
Also probably not. I mean, these are all... political songs are, by their nature, echo chamber situations.
Okay. That's somebody brings their friend to a show, and the friend has a different mindset, perhaps. And
you're assuming that in contemporary America, people have friends who have vastly different political views than they do.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Okay. It's something to think about. Let's have a beer.
Yes.
Okay, now we are shifting to the 6.5 beans. You ever had 6.5? You ever heard of it before?
Yeah, it's 6.5, of course.
Yep, out of Red Hook, Brooklyn. I went to their website, and there's actually a Google image where you can see Rocky Sullivan's in the background. I didn't realize. Do you know Rocky Sullivan's?
Yeah.
It was a Manhattan bar.
Also, I thought 6.5 was like Delaware or South Jersey or something.
No, they're out in Red Hook.
Okay.
And Rocky's used to be on like Lex and 20 and 29th maybe, but they have since moved to Red Hook, a real big live music joint, mostly with the Irish punk scene. So let's do the five beans. All right, let me read a little something. The mad scientists walked through an ancient bazaar, sniffing out ingredients for their next formulation. The stalls were buzzing with activity as exotic spice vendors promoted their fragrant wares. But what ingredient would make the fabled fifth bean? The enticing aroma of an oily, smoky pod, black cardamom, caught their attention. Now that would turn the imperial to bizarre. So it's got some, it's got some cacao, some vanilla, coffee, and of course the cardamom. So
cheers.
Here we go.
Action-packed.
Okay.
There's a lot going on there.
It hides the action with that blackness, but they are they're bouncing around in there. A lot of flavors. It's, like we said before, it is black as night here. And
it's got a really peculiar scent that I can't quite place.
Okay, give it another scent. See if any adjectives, any maybe some vanilla?
I guess.
Okay. It is a hard one to place.
For some reason what's jumping into my mind is
no wrong answers here. It's okay.
This is going to be unfair to the beer, which I like a great deal, but there's something laundry detergent-y about it.
I've never heard that description of a beer before. Okay.
Like a public laundromat with watery detergent or the powdery stuff.
Interesting. That's what you're smelling, huh? Okay.
No, it's not, but
it's what comes to mind.
That's the first thing that jumped into my mind.
That's the image. Okay. It's kind of an uber stout here. I know you mentioned before.
Holy moly.
Yeah,
spicy.
It's, 10%, so it's a big, 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 bold beer. Maybe a Thanksgiving brew, you know, after the relatives have cleared out. And
one could. I guess he's not a brother-in-law, but feels like, who's a six-point fanatic and a beer enthusiast.
Okay.
Actually, last Thanksgiving brought a whole cartload of beers like this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He actually has a tattooed on his left shoulder a pumpkin patch with the pumpkin, the 6-point pumpkin bottle.
Oh my god.
Nestled in the patch.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
He loves his 6-point.
He loves his 6-point.
That's
funny. I mean, the result of which is I was totally hammered before we even got to dinner.
Yeah, and asleep by
on
by
this
7,
kind of
yeah.
beer, you know.
Okay. Okay, so maybe an end of the night kind of nightcap. All right. Are you fit to read from the book here, you think?
Yeah, of course.
All right, let's do it. You want to give us a little idea of what part of the book you're reading from here?
Yeah. Just
what do we need to know?
So this will, by way of an overview, this is from the introduction, and it's a little bit of a reverie about the touring life.
Okay. Okay, so this is Franz reading from The Humorless Ladies of Border Control.
There's a great deal of similarity between touring life and military life. Small groups of men, and it is still almost always men, of disparate backgrounds, bonded by close quarters, foreign places, and meager rations, engaged in activities of dubious purpose, but governed by vague and powerful ideals, patriotism, punk rock, machismo. The rules are the same. Do your job, pack light, defend your gang, don't get off the boat, beware of strangers. Sleep stacked 3 deep in bus bunks like submariners or curled in hard foxhole corners. Release your tensions in promiscuity, alcoholism, and violence. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your feet dry. Above all, don't complain. And, like army men, when we finish our tours of duty, even if we remain in the touring world, we lose our taste for adventure. We return, like World War II veterans creating the Eisenhower suburbs, and quickly domesticate. We pair off, leave the cities for places like the Hudson Valley, Northern California, or Oxford, Mississippi, places within driving distance of an airport and a music scene, but far from chance encounters with tour acquaintances. We drink quietly and alone, avoid loud bars and rock shows as places of entertainment and possibility. We tell and retell, buff and hone, our debauched and criminal war stories with those who were there when we see them. In a mutual, fictionalizing reassurance that what we did had some meaning, that we fought for the right side and maybe even won a small skirmish here and there. To outsiders, we no longer brag. We're no longer sure we were noble. Now I lived like a pack mule, a dumb and anonymous brute whose only purpose was to carry weight from one place to another. Accordion in a backpack on my shoulders, a day bag slung from my neck over my chest, a banjo in my left hand, my right dragging a suitcase full of CDs, vinyl records, and t-shirts with my name on them. From Brooklyn by subway to Manhattan, by train to Newark, by air to Frankfurt or Krakow or London, by cab to some club or another, dragging bumping bags across cobblestones to a kebab and pizza storefront to wait out a winter downpour. Often it was cold. I should have brought my overcoat, I would think, but that would have meant too much excess weight and bulk. You don't travel for comfort. You travel to justify the daily discomfort, what in the last century would have been called existential neurosis. It's a kind of therapy. The nagging doubt, sadness, weariness, the sense of being a stranger in a world viewed at an oblique angle. Suddenly, miraculously, all has a reason. You've been traveling. It's not your past, your guilt, your family. It's just the road. You are tired and sore. You are a stranger. I lived like a pack mule, but I had to exude the appearance of ease and confidence. I packed carefully. I traveled alone out of thrift. The shows were rarely large, but I never lost money. It was a point of pride, but also a necessity and a justification. I lived like a wealthy man, though I spent as little as possible. I had little to spend. I sometimes traveled with musicians whom hundreds of people paid to see and who were provided with bread, cheese, beer, fruit, hot food, orange juice. I scavenged like a half-forgotten house guest. I nibbled trail mix by the handful like a rodent. I crushed single-serving bottles of water in my fist as if my thirst might expose me if it itself was exposed. I chipped my front tooth on the rubber cork of a bottle of wine. I had pushed it in too deeply and taken it in my teeth and twisted the bottle to squeak it loose. A true cork might have torn or bruised, but the stubborn rubber ripped the tip of the tooth before popping free. Just a flake, a grain of sand on a pristine bedsheet, but like the princess, my tongue grew restless in its sleep, probing, rubbing, aware. Be inconspicuous all day, I learned, except for the 30 minutes on stage when you must be the most conspicuous thing in the room. Your livelihood depends on being unable to ignore. Artistry has nothing to do with it. Anyone can ignore a good song, but few can ignore someone singing even a terrible one in their face. They want to be entertained, but they don't want it actively. You must both convince them of their need and fulfill it. You are the bottle and the wine, the vessel and the salve. They are the stubborn cork to which you put your jaw, in a grin that is both welcome and a challenge, like strange dogs meeting in an alley. Whose will is stronger? Is your wheedle wilier than their indifference? Can you bully or seduce them, or turn their curiosity into interest, and then to attention? And for what? The restless tongue probes the tooth. I marked my aging by renunciations. First I traveled with a band of nine, then with five, then with none. I sloughed off concentric circles of friends. My college friends and then my band friends stopped noticing I was away and filled my empty chair with others. Then instead of friends, I had passing acquaintances with fake names, whom I saw once a year when I came back through their town, if I ever saw them again. Time passed and my body began to set its own contracting boundaries. First, I couldn't sleep on floors anymore. Then I couldn't sleep on couches, and finally I couldn't sleep in shared rooms.
Huh, nicely done. A completely unique take of on the scruffy charms of life on the road for a musician. So what's coming up? Any readings, any signings, any events for you?
What's coming up? Book stuff, I'm doing a week on the West Coast in January.
Mm-hmm.
So Bellingham, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and L.A.
Fun.
I'm really excited to do a thing at Powell's,
mm-hmm.
which is the greatest bookstore
in Portland,
in the country, okay. if not the world.
Okay.
All apologies to the Strand, but Powell's is really, that was a place where every time I was coming through Portland, I would save up and scrounge on the whole rest of the tour because I knew I needed to drop $100 at Powell's before soundcheck.
Okay.
So I'm excited for that. And then there's these Hold Steady shows in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
That'll be exciting.
Yep. So you spent years with the Hold Steady, and then you left
Five
to kind
years.
Of... Okay.
Yeah.
And then went on to do your own thing. So playing in the Brooklyn shows, but future thereafter, not quite yet determined. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. There's been no talk of anything after that. I mean, the band itself was pretty inactive, as I understand, for 2 years before
mm-hmm.
this... as well, so it's not like I'm
you haven't missed
jumping
out.
It's not like I wasn't there for a couple records and some tours, but it's not like I'm jumping into a moving vehicle.
Sure Do you figure into the songwriting for the Hold Steady?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Lyrics as well?
No, the
okay.
lyrics are all Craig.
Okay, I gotcha.
Occasionally for background vocals, I would have an idea for a background melody and I would say, can you come up with a lyric that fits this melody and syllabic structure.
I gotcha.
And
okay.
he would throw me something from that.
And obviously...
No, the lyrics were all his.
Okay. A critically adored band, and not, if not a giant band, a band that a lot of people count as their favorite band, I think it's fair to say. What compelled you to kind of leave those years ago?
That's a very complicated question.
Like, okay.
I've never come up with a pithy answer because there's no good answer because people want from that answer that it be something in a sentence that they understand.
Okay.
And instead it's just a combination of things like trying to explain why you leave a marriage. Like there's all kinds of reasons why it wasn't working anymore.
Okay.
Right? Some of them were personal. Some of them were about, you know, the different ambitions that different people had. Some of them were creative, you know, like where what's the next step after this point.
Yeah.
There's almost no point in rehashing it at this point because it's a fait accompli and everybody has their opinion on it.
I got you. Well, I mean, the fact that you are back at least for the shows coming up means that, you know, it's certainly not ill-will.
Everybody's been very comfortable about the whole thing. There's been absolutely no drama in these shows.
Yeah.
There's very little at stake in revisiting a bunch of work, a body of work that people really like.
Sure.
And playing it for them.
Sure. A win-win, as they say in the work world, right?
All the internal, buttings of heads and jockeying for position has sort of settled out the way it's supposed to settle out.
Good.
So that doesn't come to play in these sorts of situations.
Right. Tickets still available for those shows? Are they all sold out?
They're sold out. There will be some tickets available, I think, day of or at the door.
And that's what, Brooklyn Bowl?
Brooklyn Bowl, November 30th to December 3rd. Four nights with some awesome openers, which I guess they're not publicizing, but people will not be disappointed.
Who are they? Who's opening?
I guess I can't tell you. But they're bands that people would pay to see otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Take a couple more sips of the 12% beer, and maybe we can get the answer out of here.
Off the air.
Okay. All right. Fine. We're gonna do the speed round, and then we're gonna wrap things up here.
Sure.
Yep. For a speed round. Okay. U.S. city with the best punk scene.
Well, Philadelphia for a long time has held that crown.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Book that everyone else seemed to love that I didn't get.
Good one. I wonder. There's a lot of books about music that people love that I don't care for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that I want to. I'm going to have name names.
Okay.
But
memoir.
There's multiple.
Okay.
But my point being that the way people write about music and the people who want to read about music is so far removed from the way people who make music experience the making and consuming of music.
Okay.
It's a very tricky thing to do. This is a class I want to teach sometime about writing about music.
Yeah.
A part of that is just a function of the history of how music, how writing about music has developed, which is that at some point in the 50s and 60s, it broke off from the mainstream of art criticism, the capital A and a capital C, mm-hmm. and became much more about the fan experience.
Okay.
Which is what it is, but writing about music, especially these days, is so much more writing about, perceptions and narratives and lifestyle, music as a lifestyle product and stuff like that, that I find it hard to appreciate the kind of writing about music that a lot of the people who like it appreciate.
Okay, all right.
Which makes me sound snobbish or elitist, maybe, but it's
your honest answer, that's fine.
It's the honest answer. It's the answer of a practitioner talking about consumers.
Yeah. Okay. If I could have just one beer for the rest of my life.
Well, you want a versatile beer then.
Yes. Absolutely.
That you can drink
morning beer
any time of the day in any amount of quantities.
Good.
Hopefully without putting too much weight on yourself. So this is
all worthwhile factors.
This is gonna sound heretical, I think, on a beer podcast.
Okay.
But I might take Corona Light.
Okay, that's all the time we have here, folks. Thank you. No. No wrong answers here. There are some that come very close to being wrong answers, but okay, all right.
Yeah. I like Mexican beers.
Okay.
Let me say this.
Could you just upgrade it to Corona and not the Light?
No. If we're not doing Light, then I would take a Sol or a Pacifico.
Okay.
I really like Mexican beers. There are situations in which I want to drink a beer in which I don't want it to make me drunk.
Okay.
I just want to have a slight beer experience, And a lot of the beers that people really appreciate, which I also appreciate,
right.
They appreciate for the flavor and the alcohol content.
Such as the ones we're
drinking. but, one beer for the rest of my life, I would take a much, much lighter beer.
Okay. Okay.
Because you can always add. You always have an additive capacity.
Yeah.
If you want to get more drunk.
Okay.
You know, with a very light beer.
All right. All right.
But if you want, but I find it very difficult to drink half a beer.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
So.
Okay.
You're talking about the rest of your life. That's that you have to cover a lot of ground.
Even though I came up with the question, I hadn't really thought it through. So, fair point.
A beer that you can, like, you wouldn't want to drink this beer in 100-degree weather. You could drink it in the dead of winter.
I would find an air-conditioned room somewhere to drink the beer, no?
Assuming you have air conditioning available. We're talking about the possibility, the entirety of the possibility of life.
I really had not thought this through entirely. Okay. Not to say my answer would be the Corona Light, but you raised some...
I urge you to reconsider the premise of your question.
I thought of it as a throwaway question, but it's obviously so much more here.
I've thought a lot of... As someone who enjoys beer and its effects, and it's part of my daily life, I've thought a great deal about this sort of thing.
All right. Favorite New York bar?
Favorite New York bar? Well, I guess I better say Lake Street.
Okay.
That's Bobby Drake's bar.
Okay.
I love Barbez downtown in Park Slope because I think is the most amazing music bar in town, in terms of they have a really carefully curated music lineup. It's a very small room, two acts every night. You can walk in there every night and see extraordinary musicians and never be disappointed.
Yeah.
And it's suggested donation, pass the hat situation.
That all works.
Barbez in Brooklyn for a place to go and drink and have an experience. I gotta give them.
Okay. And you're teaching up at Bard?
I teach part-time at Bard, yeah.
Okay. Teaching music?
I teach in the music department one class a semester.
Okay. Very cool.
I'm sort of the music department utility knife. I
gotcha.
I'm around and they plug me in where needed.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're well-suited for it with your varied experience. What are you working on next book-wise? You got another one of mine?
I have two that are in progress. One fiction and one nonfiction.
Really?
Yeah. Fiction being sort of the next challenge.
Yeah.
Like having written book-length nonfiction.
Okay.
Now can I write book-length fiction? So I'm, 70 pages deep into that. Huh. So
working with the same agent for this one? Haven't told the agent yet.
Well, no, he knows. Okay. I don't think he's enthusiastic about that.
Oh, really? Okay.
But
well, he hasn't seen the manuscript.
He hasn't seen the manuscript, yeah.
Okay.
And then the nonfiction one where that stands right now is I've done a great deal of interviewing for it, so I have about 70 hours of interviews that need to be transcribed, so that's like a major practical barrier.
The least fun part of being an author.
The worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awful.
Anything you could say about that?
I'd rather not, just in case I don't get through that barrier.
I gotcha.
And because neither of these things are going to come out for 2 years.
Yeah.
At least. At the absolute earliest, you know.
All right.
Because of the pace of things.
Whenever you're ready to talk about it, keep books and beer in mind here. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up here, but a huge thank you to Franz Nicolai, author of The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And just a quick couple thank yous as well. Frank Tantillo always helps me produce this show and make it sound pretty good. Thank you to him. And Andrew Albanese wrote our great, great theme song. And thank you all for listening. This is Mike Malone signing off on Books and Beer. Oh.